This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
It is perhaps fitting that we should be having this chat just after Ash Wednesday.
Yes.
Because this poem has been so meaningful to you all through your life. Why has it been so important? What has it said to you?
First of all, I first encountered it at a moment of personal breakthrough. For years after leaving the convent, I'd not been able to respond personally and profoundly to literature. And this was a huge sorrow to me because I had, before I entered religion, loved reading poetry. And I'd always felt deeply touched within, lifted momentarily beyond myself. But there was nothing. I was unable to respond. And the first time, it was some years after I left, I was at a lecture given by Dame Helen Gardner. And she read the first poem of Ash Wednesday. And for the first time, I felt myself spiritually leaping out towards the poem. And it spoke to me immediately because it was about spiritual recovery. It is about spiritual convalescence, as it were. And the image of the spiral staircase is, in most mythologies, it's the image of a breakthrough to a change of consciousness. And I was making a change of consciousness from an extreme despair, and indeed illness, physical illness, to a much more joyous and affirmative way of looking at the world. And I loved particularly, there were some lines that made immediate sense to me. The poet says he gives up the blessed face. He doesn't expect any longer to see the blessed face of God. But because of this, he rejoices. Consequently, I rejoice, he says, having to construct something upon which to rejoice. And I took that as a sort of lodestar, a pointer, that if I couldn't be immediately happy, then I was going to have to work at it, to construct it.
And that was okay.
That was okay, because once you start doing it, it's like riding a bicycle. You can't sit and think about riding a bicycle. You have to get onto the bike and you find yourself doing it. And once you've taught your mind, I think, to perhaps not look on the bright side, I'm not a great one for positive thinking, but to see that all is not necessarily lost, that you can go on. If you give up hope, as the poet says, hope comes back to you. If you give up unrealistic expectations and unrealistic strivings and resign yourself to what you actually have, then you can begin to learn to rejoice.
How did you go about mending your mind? You write about the convent as having essentially robbed you of the ability to respond to poetry, to respond to literature, robbed you of your ability to feel, to think. How did you make yourself whole again?
There was one important thing, was that I was suffering, though I didn't know it, from undiagnosed temporal lobe epilepsy. And I was sent off to see psychiatrists. And a major part of the trauma of these years of leaving the convent was thinking I was losing my mind. I would be overcome with a paralyzing sense of utter despair and dread and terror. Doctors say that this terror of the temporal lobe epileptic is the terror that people experience when they are actually dying because their brain is in convulsion. And I'd go to somewhere and then find myself somewhere completely different. And I would look at money in my purse and not know what it was for. It was a sense of jamais vu, as they call it, never having seen it before. And I couldn't respond to the world while I thought I was losing my mind. I thought I would end up in a locked ward. And I went to psychiatrists. They all told me I was just under a strain. And finally, I got diagnosed properly.
By someone who was appalled, we should say, at the number of doctors, psychiatrists, hospital people you had seen over the years.
Yes, he was a neurologist and he said to me, why didn't you take these symptoms to a doctor? And you've been like this for 4 years, you say. And I said, yes. And he said, do you mean to tell me that you have been seen by men and women, all of whom are trained doctors? And none of them suggested you had an EEG test. He said, these are classic symptoms. So, but that, I felt that my mind had been given back to me. So that was a major breakthrough. But also, more than anything else, it has been my study that has brought me back to a sense of religion, because I kept on trying to do all kinds of things for which I wasn't suited. And every single thing that I tried to do failed. I wanted to be an academic. I wanted to teach English literature in a university. And I failed my PhD with horrible publicity and horrible scandal. Then I had to go into school teaching. And because I was ill, I lost my job. Then I went into television. I said that to Bill Moyers once, and he said, oh, in television, we take anybody. but even that didn't last long, because there was a crisis with one of my programs, and I was discredited, and that was the end of my broadcasting career. And then I started, faute de mieux, really, to write full-time, studying religion. And in the course of living a lot in silence, because I was no longer involved in busy schedules and living in silence, I began to see what the words in the sacred texts were about. You can't read a sonnet at a party, and you can't read theology, which is poetry, in a state of constant flux. And gradually, by means of study, I learned various, what I call the disciplines of ecstasy, of going outside yourself and putting yourself in the place of another.
But you mentioned some of these setbacks, and you write so candidly in the book that at one point you say, other people seem to go through life with less drama. They find a career, they find a partner. Me, I'm continually having these doors slammed in my face. And I found it difficult to read for that reason in some moments, because I kept having to reassure myself, it's okay, it's Karen Armstrong, she's fine, she writes some really good books. You wouldn't have had that comfort while you were living it.
No, not at all. I mean, I thought I was really finished. First of all, I seemed to be losing my mind. And then, even then, I was a failed academic. I couldn't even hold down a school teaching job. I was living constantly hand to mouth. And my other friends were all sailing on to proper lives, and I was still scrabbling around in this student existence and really feeling that I wasn't getting to the core of my life, that I kept being foiled in some way and it wasn't going right. And I felt I was wasting myself in, I wasn't engaged somehow. And yet, you know, for all that, I look back on these setbacks, and thank goodness they happened. Because had I been an academic, I'd now be teaching at this very moment in a minor university in England. And though that might have been pleasant, I've had a much more interesting life and much more fulfilling and exciting life. So I'm glad I didn't become an academic.
Well, it's one of the lovely phrases in your poem here, Ash Wednesday. I'm going to stop desiring this man's yes. gift and that man's scope, because yes. that's just not the way. I'm interested in some of these hard lessons you've had to learn along the way. You say the minute you stopped trying to exploit your gifts, to make a name for yourself, to advance your career, a whole world opened up to you. Tell me about that.
Well, when I finally fell into television, at first, my programs, because I didn't know much about religion at that point, I was teaching, learning on the job, one step ahead of the production company. And because of that, the character, Karen Armstrong, was very much central. They were very debunking programs. I was witty, entertaining, and constantly slightly undercutting what I was doing and being clever. The point was to be clever. Now, this suited secular Britain beautifully, because Britain has a very dim view of religion. So these skeptical programs went down very well. But once I had my television career was over, and there I was with a blank page. I had no one to be clever to. And so there was no one to exclaim to about the irrationality of a Greek Orthodox doctrine, for example. And in the silence, the poetry began to reverberate for me in a different way. Another thing was, an important moment was when I came to write my biography of the Prophet Muhammad. I did it at the time of the Salman Rushdie crisis, when literary London was in turmoil, and people were saying some very hard and inaccurate distorting things about Islam. And this struck me as very dangerous, because after the Nazi Holocaust, we've seen where this kind of cultivated inaccuracy and prejudice can lead. So I decided to write a biography of Muhammad, but this was a very tense time, and people feared that I might be joining Salman in hiding, because the Muslim community wouldn't like, they thought, a woman, a Western woman, writing about their prophet. But the important thing, first of all, was that I had to go onto the back burner. Karen Armstrong could not be in evidence, because this was a matter of extreme sensitivity to the Muslim community at this time, and indeed in literary London. So I had to put I in the background. Second, I had to go beyond myself. I had to put, even though I didn't believe in God at that stage, I had to put myself in the position of a man who felt he'd been touched by God. And if I didn't get that, I would miss the essence of Muhammad. And it was by putting yourself deliberately out into the position of another person that I began to change. And all the great world religions I now know, though I didn't know at the time, say that if you want to have vision, you must put your ego to one side and not keep blazoning and posturing and preening with the ego. Put it to one side and you begin to see things in a different way. Yoga, for example, is all about taking the I, ego, out of our thinking, so that when we look at something, we no longer think, do I want this, or how is that going to affect me? But you see the thing as it is, clear, with its own integral beauty.
Yes, it's fascinating, though, because it sounds like you end up on this spiritual path almost in spite of yourself.
I had no intention of starting a spiritual path. The major book was a History of God, and I intended this to be one of my debunking things. But gradually, putting yourself in the position of the other, it getting into the minds of the theologians who, through the centuries, had written about God, and not leaving an idea until I had found myself thinking, I can understand why and how people could think or believe or feel this. Then I found later that I was studying, I was actually achieving what they call the science of compassion. Compassion not meaning sorry for somebody, but feeling with. And all the world religions say that religion's not about thinking things, as I thought it was. It's about doing things, behaving in ways that change you.
I want to take you back to that compassion point in a minute, because it's so central to the story you're telling in the book. But I want to stay with this transformation in you, because the book shows it is a transformation from the ex-nun who's really on a roll delivering these smart-ass TV commentaries on why religion is bonkers, to the woman who drops the cleverness, drops the wittiness, drops all the poses, and really delves into religion in a very quiet way. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think it is I do see my work as a form of contemplation, as a form of prayer. Even though I can't talk to God, I've always been absolutely hopeless, even in my nun-like days, at praying. I could never keep my mind on my meditation for more than 2 minutes at a time.
Is that still the case? Do you pray now?
No, I don't. I can't do it. Sometimes I sit quietly, just sitting. But for me, my study is prayer. Now, my rabbi colleagues tell me that I should have been a rabbi, because this is what Jews do when they immerse themselves in the sacred text and get glimmers of transcendence. We all have to find our own way in prayer. So first of all, it was a form of prayer. But also, I found I was living differently, thinking differently in order to do my writing. And by having continually to put myself in the position of somebody like Muhammad until I could feel with him, meant I had to leave Karen Armstrong behind. Now, that's a form of ecstasy. The word ecstasy means to ecstasis. It means to go beyond the self. Huh. It doesn't mean having an exotic state of consciousness or going into a trance. It means that you put yourself aside. And I think that a lot of the time we're worried about religion, we're thinking about transcendence,
yes,
going beyond, and what we're transcending to. So what is the nature of God, Jesus, etc. But really, I think it's what you transcend from, what you're going away from, which is ego, greed. And once you've lost ego and greed, you find you've lost a lot of fear.
This gets us into a really interesting point, an epiphany of sorts you reached. When you realize that perhaps belief is not the foundation upon which everything else rests, because I think for many of us that has been an obstacle. Well, if I can't quite have the sort of faith I want to have and the sort of belief I want to have, then the whole game is over.
Yes.
You discovered perhaps belief is not at the center of all of this.
It's largely, it's basically Christianity that has made belief such a bugbear, and that only in the last 200 years or so since the Enlightenment. A real breakthrough came to me when I was talking to a Jewish scholar friend of mine. And we were sitting in a...
Is this
in a,
Chaim Maccabee?
Chaim Maccabee.
Yes.
We were sitting in a greasy spoon cafe eating egg sandwiches. and he said, he told me the story of Hillel, the older contemporary of Jesus, a great rabbi, Pharisee, who some Gentiles came to him and said they would convert to Judaism if Hillel could recite the whole of Jewish teaching, the whole of the Torah, while he stood on one leg. So Hillel stood on one leg and said, "Do not do unto others what you would not have done unto you." That's the Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn it. And I said, well, that's an extraordinary thing. What were these pagans, these Gentiles, supposed to believe? And Chaim said, it's easy to see you were brought up Christian. In Judaism, well, you can basically believe what you want within reason, but it's doing things. It is behaving in a certain way so that it changes you. It's like an ethical alchemy. And I have come to think that Hillel is absolutely right. That is the epitome of religion. If we did the golden rule day by day, seriously, if every time we were about to say something horrible about an annoying colleague or a sibling or a country with whom we're at war and refrained because we said, how would I like this said to me or of my own people? In that moment, we would have gone beyond ego. And we would be living in a state of constant low-burning ecstasies. And I found I was doing that in my study, not intentionally, but I had to do it in order to write the books that I did. And that meant that I was changed a lot, a new happiness came.
You talk about having developed compassion as a habit of mind and the fact that this turns out to be one of the great social liabilities. In what way does it put you in a jam in the culture in which we live?
You mean writing about religion?
No, the idea of, I think there's a point in the book where you say, developing compassion as a habit of mind has been somewhat painful because in our society it's a liability. There's the disdain that just peppers run-of-the-mill conversation.
Run-of-the-mill conversation. And I it is a bit of a liability because I have, on a social occasion, sometimes been reduced to tears almost because I find the unkindness and the lack of concern for accuracy and truth almost unbearable. Now, I can't go around like this, so you have to pull yourself together and go on. But once your heart becomes more tender and it becomes almost intolerable to hear the not just social conversation, that's bad enough, but political discourse, especially at the moment, which is so hate-ridden and so bound up with the beleaguered ego and wanting to hurt the other on all sides. And this, we seem bent on a terribly destructive course. It is painful, unbearably painful. But on the other hand, if you, and sometimes religious people look annoyed because if I talk about compassion, they'll sometimes look at me mutinously because if you can't disapprove of other people, what's the fun of being religious? I mean, there's no sense in it. But a lot of people lighten up because that what our world needs now is not more certainty. We've seen too much certainty, political and religious certainty recently. What we need is compassion to be able to feel with the other. And this is what changes us. I have a little theory as to what all the religions say this. The Chinese say it. Confucius talks about shu, likening to oneself. Always thinking, how would I like this done to me, said to me. Young, he says, yielding to the other. And they're not doing this just because it sounds nice or edifying, but because this is what works. If we want to be creative, you can't be a good artist and be full of ego, trumpeting about me and my feelings. Somehow you've got to transcend that ego. And religion is an art form. And it's something that teaches us to behave, never mind what you believe. it teaches you to behave in a way that changes you and gives you intimations of what people call God or nirvana.
You're listening to Tapestry on CBC Radio 1. I'm Mary Hines with Karen Armstrong. Your book, Muhammad, A Biography of the Prophet, was described by one Muslim scholar as a love story. And he says to you, Karen, I think if you had met the prophet, you would have consented to be his 15th wife. Were you taken unawares by your affection for this man, by your respect for the prophet?
Absolutely. Because the lovely thing about Muhammad is that he's written about by his early biographers, warts and all. They don't attempt to whitewash him. And you see the prophet as very much a human being. You very rarely see Jesus laughing, but you do see Muhammad laughing, teasing, playing with his grandchildren, having his grandchildren on his shoulders. You see him weeping. You see him in anguish and terror and despair, and yet bringing something extraordinary. What he did was bring peace to a war-torn region. And by teaching, the bedrock message of the Quran is to be good to others. And never mind about beliefs of which the Quran is very scathing, but to be good to others. Now, of course, this is distorted with a lot of Muslim belief now, because this is, and there was something irreducibly sweet about this man who was struggling, and you felt that if a man who was so beleaguered and in such desperate straits and was so utterly human could achieve transcendence and have such an effect on the world, there was hope for all of us that religion isn't just about high-minded people or saints, the saints of my childhood, who always seemed to be of impossible, impenetrable virtue. Here was a human being.
And yet since September 11th, it's almost become a full-time job for you to go around the world, particularly in North America, parts of Europe, explaining that, no, Islam is not about violence.
Yes, it's not about violence. The word Islam comes from the same root as salam, peace. I'm finding now in my studies that, like all the great world religions, Islam included, begins in a recoil from violence and cruelty. And this is going to be the subject of my next book. But it's terribly important that we, at this time of great peril, that we see things accurately. It's very important to know who our enemies are. But it's equally important to know who our enemies are not. The extremists who are perverting Islam in this murderous, wicked way are a tiny minority.
When you set out to write A History of God, the book that would change your life, friends and publishers and the very smart set in London, everyone was appalled. And the consensus seemed to be, but Karen, it's also religious.
Yes. Don't do it, they said, yes.
Is that one of the great dirty words of our time, religious?
Not in the United States, it isn't. The United States is the second most religious country in the world after India. But in Britain and in parts of Europe, people are not religious on principle, almost, because religion is seen to be something without integrity or validity. Or there's a certain secular fundamentalism or a secularist disdain for all this.
Was there a sophistication, that says this is not for sophisticates?
This is bonkers. You can't believe this rubbish. And, of course, you say, well, of course, it isn't about believing things, and then they look at you annoyed and say, you know, well, they don't want that because they've made up their minds. So I'll be very interested to know how they're going to make do with this memoir, really, because it'll be interesting to see how they cope. It's not out in England yet.
Oh, it's not?
No.
Were you tempted at all to whitewash any aspects of this? It's searing. It's so honest.
There's no point. I didn't want to write this book. I had my arm slightly twisted by one of my editors because writing about yourself is very difficult. And there seems to be absolutely no point in doing it unless you're going to be honest and tell the truth. Then if you go down deep enough, you get to a level beyond the triviality, I think, of the thing. I hate those kind of biographies where people are endlessly parading around and being told how wonderful they are, you know. But I actually found it a helpful discipline. it was a form of contemplation. I did a little bit every day. I didn't spend great chunks of time at it. But it was a little meditation, trying to look back on my life, to assess things, to see, well, that's what I thought then, but now how would I view it?
Would a memoir, though, be the antithesis of what you've found to be so spiritually helpful, and that is setting the ego aside?
That's one of the reasons why I didn't want to write it. But I was continually being asked when I was going on tours like this about my own religious life. And actually, it helped clarify things for me. And I'd got right up to the penultimate chapter when September the 11th happened. And I simply laid the book aside. I couldn't think of my own little ups and downs at this time of great crisis. It just suddenly seemed pointless. But all the time, the ideas were rumbling around my head. And somehow September the 11th made sense of, in a horrible way, of a lot of where my work had been going to, because I had for many years had a terrible feeling of dread that we were heading for a great darkness with the Muslim world. Hence, a lot of my work had been about Jerusalem, Muhammad, Islam, fundamentalism, because I felt there was something here that was going to blow up in our faces. Of course, it did. So that in its also helped me to come to the last chapter and see what my life might have meant. We all need this to take stock from time to time.
Yes.
To see, well, where did I want to go? Where have I actually got? And now where am I going? Because this is not the last word, of course. I'm still alive. And while you're alive, you're changing all the time.
The world knows you as such a scholar of the great religions. It's so funny to read about a time when you knew so little about them. Mm. And I was laughing reading about you're in the synagogue going to a baby naming.
Yes.
And looking around and thinking, man, this is kind of a lively place. People make noise here. They show their emotions. They're having a good time. They're yelling to one another. This Judaism is not at all what I'd been taught. Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember it very well. This was constantly happening as in the early stages. I had a very, very parochial religious upbringing. It was Catholic. That was it. And we didn't even know much about Protestants, for heaven's sake. And actually, this discovery of other religions, the discovery of Judaism, Islam, Greek and Russian Orthodox Christianity, and finally Buddhism, which was just extraordinarily revealing to me. It showed me what religion could be. It showed me what my own tradition had been trying to do at its best. And then I could reassess my own tradition more kindly and see, well, this religion, there's much more about it than I had been aware of, despite my intensely religious childhood and youth.
So do you end up, when you look back on your faith of origin, I mean, there's so much, the convent years scarred you so deeply. Do you look back in anger?
No. Because, you see, the nuns themselves were going through a painful period of transition. This was the time of the 1960s. The reforms of the Vatican Council were coming into effect. They had to change. And the old way of life was going, and nothing new had come to take its place. So I was the last person to go through the old system. And I had it at its worst when everyone was feeling insecure, defensive, and perhaps going a bit over the top. We had a particularly conservative novice mistress. But I don't regret it because after all, what am I doing now? I'm a kind of nun. I mean, I live alone.
How do you mean?
I live alone. I spend my entire day when I'm not on tour writing, thinking, speaking about God and spirituality. I've never married. Now, of course, there are lots of un-nun-like things. I have some money and I travel and I love the good things of life and eating out and good wine and I have wonderful friends and have a lot of fun. But I think that the convent was a first stab, perhaps, at the kind of life I have now, but which wasn't sort of open to me at the time. And if it hadn't been for the convent, I wouldn't have started on this journey at all. It's put me on a path. And of course, that path went through some really grim and horrible patches. It threw me off. It seemed to have thrown me right off course. It seemed to have made it impossible for me to relate to the world in any permanent, fulfilling way. But when I came right back to the solitary lifestyle and the theology, everything fell into place.
Do you go so far then as to say, well, then everything clearly does happen for a reason. Or are you more in the meaningless camp?
No, I think you can't say that, because I think if you look at the horrors that people endure throughout the world, I mean, I've had an extraordinarily privileged life, as we all do in the First World, but you look at the horrors, and some of it that could have been avoided with better policies and better wealth sharing and concern. So I can't quite say that, but I do think you need to listen very hard to your instincts, to your unconscious, and not do as I did for so long, desire this man's gift and that man's scope, wanting things that are not right for you. As the late Joseph Campbell said, you find your bliss, and that takes you to the center of your life. And when you're at the center of your life, then you are centered. A dancer, I believe, dances from a still center in the midst of herself. A painter does the same thing. And we've all got to do this. And for me, it's writing about theology. For other people, it might be a marriage or a relationship or a legal career or even a career in business. To do what you are doing as well and as compassionately as you can, that takes you to the center of your life. And I think, too, the compassion is something I wanted to say, too. I have a little theory about it, that we are biologically programmed to defend ourselves. You know, the survival of the fittest, that we have to. We're animals. We have to look out for predators. But if we lay that aside, as the religions have been trying to teach us to do, and look into the other and lay aside that I, me, defensive, then I think we do enter into a different state of consciousness. That if we try to live day to day and out, and we keep tripping up and making mistakes and failing at it, but then I think we get first to the center of our lives, to the center of our bliss, and then also we achieve ecstasies, we go beyond ourselves and achieve the kind of peace and glimmers of transcendence that the great theologians and sages have described.
You're very blunt about your early forays into religion as a journalist, as a TV performer, and you write in the book, "I had wanted to show that religion was indeed bonkers." Although you've left that persona behind, it sure sounds like you had some fun. Do you ever the irreverence of that approach?
Oh, yes. Look, I had a lot of fun. And all those that time in television was just wonderful fun. And I think one of the things that one should do in religion is laugh more.
We don't hear that too often, do we?
No, we don't. But I think we should laugh more. And I think the Jews have this. Largely, they have a wonderful humour, largely because of the great tragedy that they've experienced, because often laughter and tears come from a similar point. And our life is absurd. And I think if we could laugh at ourselves a bit more, I think that's important, not take ourselves too seriously.
One of your moments in compassion in the book is for the reader. And I found this so intriguing because you write, "I can almost hear an exasperated reader ask, 'Okay, does this woman believe in God or not?'" So how do you answer that?
I said, what I went on to say was, surely this is the religious question, is it not? Do you believe in God or not? And I said, well, no, actually, it isn't the religious question. That was what was the surprise to me.
But that's how you answer it in the book.
Yes.
I want to see how you answer it in the interview. To a straight question, do you believe in God?
I can't answer that. It's such a misplaced question. It's what people used to ask the Buddha. Does Nirvana exist or not? And he'd say, this is an improper question. We have no words, no concept, no idea about this. Live in a certain way and you'll understand what God is, but not sort of notionally. Do I believe in, it depends what you mean by God, do I believe in a personalized deity who created the world and who manages it? I don't. I tried to work with that personalized deity and it didn't work. I couldn't make that work. Do I believe that there is an absolute holiness in life? Yes, I see it in the world. I saw it this morning from my hotel room in Toronto as the sun came up. I see it in other people. I see it in the great work that works of theology that I'm studying and immersed in all the time. There is great holiness in life, but we have to train ourselves to look for it,
But that could exist without any sort of creator or, I mean, leaving aside a being who's in control. I'm just wondering about the existence of something.
You see, the theologians all said, whether they were Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, that to say that God exists is wrong, because God doesn't exist like this microphone or this cup of water or you, me, or even as the atom. This is another kind of reality. Just as we can't, it's just as when we listen to a great work of art, a great piece of music, something happens to us, but you can't exactly say what. And that is what I think we do experience a transcendent element in our life. We do. But the minute you try and say it exists and I define it, then you've lost it. It's like trying to catch a butterfly, because the word define, definis, means to set limits on something. And once you set limits on God, then you have all kinds of disorders, I think. And it's all too easy to make this being into another personality like ourselves, writ large, with likes and dislikes similar to our own. And that way can lie religious atrocity, because you can say God hates what I hate.
And my God is right.
Yes,
my God is the way.
And then you get encased in the ego that you've got to transcend. So I think you want a heart that watches and receives, and you do receive holiness. You do see holiness. And the holy, if you like. Yes, there is the holy. But what it is, who it is it a who? Is it a what? The great scriptures, the best scriptures say you can't ask that.
Do you ever yearn for something more tangible?
No,
by
I
way
don't.
Of knowing?
No, I don't. I used to, and that was a great irritant, because when in my prayers, I kept on saying, well, when here I am praying away. This is a young, inept, immature young nun. When am I going to experience God? And I never did. Nothing ever happened. The sky remained obdurately closed, and God didn't talk to me. And I wanting certainty, I think, is a great delusion. We do want certainty, but then it can harden and become an idolatry. It can harden and become sort of righteousness and belligerence, I think. So, no, I know that if you live differently, you see differently. And that's all I can say. You see what nirvana might be. You see what God might be. There is a change in you, and that change is a reality. It is a fact of life. The transcendence you encounter has been a fact of life throughout human history. It's part of what we are. We have this hunger for the divine and the capacity to apprehend something of it.
It was a hunger for the divine which led you into the convent, this longing for the sacred that carried you into the religious life. Has that longing been satisfied?
At times, yes, I would say yes, because I get such joy from my study. I cannot tell you I'm so excited when I go. I'm about to get upstairs into the library, into the British Library reading room, or at my desk. Time passes, and I get moments of just wonder, awe, delight that leave you speechless, because you are living in the midst of some of the greatest words that have ever been spoken about the human condition. And it gives you huge moments of insight into what human beings are capable of, the vision, the courage, the holiness of human beings. And that gives one hope and joy, because getting rid of ego, I don't think I'm still a highly flawed human being. I still don't like it when people give me bad reviews or are rude to me or anything. I've still got an ego. But when you, for moments, you just get beyond it, you do experience a joy. The Buddhist texts tell you you'll do this, because it is ego that makes us miserable. It's when we wake up at 3 in the morning and we say, why haven't I got this? Why have I failed as I did all those years? Why don't I have what so-and-so has? Why is so-and-so so much more successful and I am not?
It's you have me. These thoughts?
Of course. We all have them, don't we?
I just don't think of you having them. I know I have them.
we all have our down moments. And you have to say to yourself, now, look, I'm putting this aside. This is ego talking here. If we could get beyond that, then we would be happier. This is why the Buddha said, live as though the self didn't exist. Then you'll be happy. But trying to do it on a daily basis, I don't want you to give the impression that I belong to that kind of religious thinking that bashes the ego in a sick way, you know, saying I am a miserable worm and I am hopeless and I'm a wicked, evil person. That is what the Buddha would call unskillful. It won't help you. It actually makes you so concentrate on your own failure and your own performance that you are embedded in the ego that you're supposed to be transcending. But particularly by living, trying to enter into the mind of others, what I call the spirituality of empathy. This takes you away from ego and it brings you moments of great joy. And humour too, I must say. I've laughed a lot more. I've laughed a lot since my irreverent days. That was fun, but there was often an edge to it.
Yes.
And a lot of cruelty and a lot of nudging and insecurity because you're always looking to see who was going to be the next good TV presenter and when you were going to be thrown out onto the slag heap. But now I have moments of great fun and humour. Life is so funny too. It is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is such a pleasure to talk to you.
I've loved it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Karen Armstrong. Her latest book is The Spiral Staircase, My Climb Out of Darkness. It's published by Random House. Our interview with Karen Armstrong was first broadcast in February 2004. A few days ago, the BBC asked Armstrong to comment on the violence plaguing so many countries following the series of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Armstrong wrote, "I think it was criminally irresponsible to publish these cartoons. They have been an absolute gift to the extremists. On the other hand, in a secular Europe, freedom of speech has developed as one of our sacred values. Freedom is as sacred a value for us as the Prophet is to Muslims. We are seeing here a clash of two different notions of what is sacred, and this is part of the modernizing process. We have to learn to live side by side better than this."
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in, all of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.